Genesis 3, we're looking for someone who has descended from Eve, but then it narrows in, Genesis 12, to a descendant of Abraham, and then it narrows in again in 2 Samuel 7 to a son of David, who's going to rule the world forever under God. And we think we are so, so close. But then we said nothing has been done about the source of sin. The human heart is unchanged. And nobody that we've met on the whole journey has been more than human. Nobody has been free from sin. So it took us about 10 minutes. Sin reasserted itself and we tore it all apart. In reality, it took 300 years. But we split the kingdom. We destroyed the northern parts and we destroyed the southern parts. And you would think that it was all over. That's where we left it, cheerfully. Well, it obviously isn't quite all over. I guess you know that, even if you don't know the Bible story. And here's how. So we didn't quite stress that the second kingdom, that the second destruction of the southern kingdom, happens in two stages. So in 597 BC, the king surrendered. And he, his family, the treasures of Egypt, and every human being that the Babylonians think they can use is carried away. So all the officials, the soldiers, the craftsmen, the smiths, 10,000 people go to Babylon. And they seem like the really unlucky ones. Because the captured king's uncle becomes king in Jerusalem, and life goes on for 11 more years. It looks like the ones in exile are the unlucky ones. But then 11 years later, he rebels against Babylon too. And this time, Jerusalem is flattened. And his sons are killed and the eyes are put out. And the interest in the Bible suddenly is with the 10,000, with the first group in exile. It turns out that instead of being the unlucky ones, they're the ones who've been kept safe. They're the ones inside the ark in Babylon. And actually, God's prophets have been interested in them for a long time. So if you've got that diagram of all the... Actually, I think we have now got it on screen. Click again. There it is. So two prophets in particular, Ezekiel and Jeremiah, are really interested in those exiles. Ezekiel goes with them to Babylon as a young man. He's in that group of 10,000. And while he's there, he tries to persuade them not to keep looking back at Jerusalem. He says, Jerusalem is doomed. Trust God where you are now. Trust God where you are now. Jerusalem is all over. Trust him where you are. Whereas Jeremiah, he stays behind in Jerusalem and gets to make himself very unpopular by telling the truth. So he just tells them what God is about to do. God is going to destroy the city. It's all doomed. But his attention is actually on the exiles as well. He has his book copied and sent to Babylon, and he writes a letter to the exiles. This is our point one. And we need to be in Jeremiah 29, which is page 795 in these Bibles, or the contents page is still your friend. So Jeremiah 29, if your enemies capture you and take you into exile and you have to live miles away from the promised land in the middle of your enemies, how should you live? How should you live? Well, Jeremiah 29, verse 2, verse 3 lists the various kings that we've talked about, the one in Jerusalem, the one in exile, and then where haven't we gone yet? Can we start at the front of this row here? How do you say that name? Donitza, could you read? Thank you. Jeremiah 29 and verse 7. Thank you. How should you live? When you're in Babylon in exile, you should seek the welfare of the city you're in. In fact, if you skim through verses 5 to 7, you're supposed to build houses and grow food and have kids and increase in numbers. Because God has put you in Babylon, so for as long as you are there, verse 7, its welfare is your welfare. But that isn't going to be forever, verse 10. Because in 70 years' time, God is going to visit you and bring you home. So live now for 70 years in Babylon until I bring you home. And you may know this, just going to pause slightly on this. You may know this verse. It's a verse that's used a lot to say we must transform this world now. We're citizens of London, we're citizens of Singapore, Hong Kong, we're citizens of the world. We must transform it. The mission of the world, church is to the world here. Well, I think that is about half right. Okay, so we live here, It's no good imagining that we're in heaven. We live here. You have jobs and responsibilities here now. And if you trash here, then you've trashed the place that you live. And the place you're going to live for 70 years or longer until Jesus comes back or until you die. We're going to be here for 70 years. But just notice, this isn't a program to turn Babylon into Jerusalem. What's going to happen to Babylon? Babylon is going to be judged in 70 years' time. There's no point kind of reforming Babylon, making it Jerusalem. Be a good citizen of Babylon while you're here. But in the end, God is going to judge it. This is the place to be until you go back to Jerusalem. We can have questions about that. There's some questions in there already. Kev didn't dry it before I put it there, so they're kind of quietly going soggy in the bottom. But that's fine. We can still read them. So yeah, do put questions about that in there. So remember why they're in exile. Exiles, they've been judged by God. Well, you're in exile. You need to remember that your God is loving and forgiving, and you need to turn back to him. You need to look for him and ask for his help. So could we have verses 11 to 14? Next person, 11 to 14 of Jeremiah 29.
I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans to prosper you and not harm you. Plans to give you hope and a future. Then you will call on me and cry and pray to me, and I will listen to you. You will seek me and find me when you will seek me with all your heart. I will be found by you, declares the Lord, and will bring you back from this captivity. I will gather you from all the nations and places where I have banished you, declares the Lord, and will bring you back to the place from which I carried you.
I can imagine being that generation. It's a very, very emotional time for them. They've been torn away from their home. Lots of them, while they were still quite young, they're in this foreign culture that doesn't understand them. Their home has been destroyed, or will be in a couple of years' time. And they need to accept that it was all their fault. They need to accept that it was their sin, in the face of God's patience, that took them there. And then they need to repent, and they need to turn back to God. But the moment they do turn back to God, I will hear you, I will listen to you, I will be found by you, I will bring you back. That's the plan. God is waiting. God hasn't given up on them. But for now, they have these 70 years in Babylon where they're to settle down, be good citizens, and prosper there while they're there. And while they're there, we have several history books set not in Israel at all. So in particular, we have the book of Daniel and the book of Esther, set in Babylon and in Susa. Susa is the capital of the Persians, who are the empire that take over after Babylon. And on the handout there, I've called them the stranger books, because to a Jewish reader, they're just very weird, very strange. They're books full of weird, funny, foreign customs. They're actually very funny. When I was a student, we studied Esther, and we read it through in a little Bible study group, and it's almost impossible to read without giggling. It's kind of these repeated names and the funny things they do. But more than that, they're stranger because it is about how to live as a stranger away from Israel, which makes them very, very important books for us, because the New Testament would say that is where we live. And then just click on the next sheet. We have, click on again. No, back. Thank you. There's a box on the handout just over the page, which Microsoft Word or no, PowerPoint or someone has shrunk so that you've missed half the text, which I could put this up at the end as well if you want. But to say that we've got to let the New Testament tell us how to apply the Old Testament. We don't need to guess. Jesus will tell us how to do that. The apostles will tell us. And in particular, there are two points in the Old Testament story that the New Testament goes to often to say you live somewhere like them. And it isn't the kind of happy situation in the land under King Solomon being rich and successful. It is either the wilderness generation, when they are on their way to the promised land, and they have to trust the promises of God for the future, or it is the exile generation, when they are outside of the land and have to trust God's promises. So we're in the same situation as them. If you read the Bible as you do this, if you only think the positive bits refer to you, then you're going to be very, very confused. Partly, why are all the negative bits? And also, why isn't my life as positive as the positive bits in the Bible? Actually, we need to let the Bible tell us how to read the Bible. And we are much more like wilderness and exile. Shall I leave that up, or shall I put it up at the end? Let's put it up at the end. Go back a slide. That's cruel, isn't it? You just started writing it down, and we'll put that back up at the end. So we are strangers here, aliens. We belong in the new creation. We belong with God. But we live in an exile in a Babylon where God's ways don't rule. Where to be a Christian is to be weird, is to be misunderstood, and to be threatened. So that means that Daniel and Esther are the books that you need to read to learn how to live now in that situation. So Daniel says that God is still God. Even if you have an evil emperor, even if you have a superpower, they are under his control, and God puts them where he wants them. So God didn't lose an arm wrestle with Nebuchadnezzar or with the God of Babylon. God was in control. And the catchphrase is there in Daniel chapter 4, verse 25. Don't worry about turning there, I'll read it. Daniel 4:25. The Most High rules the kingdoms of men and gives them to whom he will. And Daniel, if you remember, we preached through it at Euston not so long ago. Daniel sees and interprets visions that traces world history forwards, beyond Babylon, through Persia, Alexander the Great, the Romans, the birth of Jesus. 500 years of world history, four or five different empires, all in control of the Most High Gods, all in control of our gods, even though it didn't look like it. And that Daniel learns to trust that God, even when they say, we're going to throw you to the lions, we're going to burn you alive. God's in charge. Let's see what happens. And then Esther is a book that doesn't mention God by name, because it's meant to feel like this situation where nobody believes in God, you're all on your own. Esther is a Jewish girl who puts herself in for a sort of CD beauty contest to be the next queen of Persia. It's like X Factor with sex. And that she wins. And so she is queen the day the king is persuaded to pass a law to kill all Jews, which leaves Esther with a decision to make. So she is sort of undercover. No one knows that she's Jewish except her uncle. She can stay quiet and keep her life, or she can risk her life and try to save her people. And again, I'll read it for the sake of time. Let's go. It's Esther 4, verse 13. Her uncle says, do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this. So when you live in exile in a world where God looks absent, don't think for one minute that God has stopped rescuing. Don't think for one minute that this is out of his control. Which means every time you get a decision, you don't think, oh no, what's God doing? It's all over. You think, who knows whether I haven't been placed here for such a time as this to do God's will. He'll definitely rescue. His plan will definitely come to pass. He's in charge. But who knows whether I am the only Christian in my hall of residence for such a time as this. Who knows whether I am the only Christian that person knows at work for such a time as this. If it scares you stupid to think of, evangelizing your hall, evangelizing your workplace, well, good. You've noticed that Britain isn't the capital of the kingdom of God. We don't live at home. And Esther is brilliant. I mean this with the greatest possible respect to her, looking forward to meeting her in the new creation. But she was no great hero of the faith. She's a kind of cross between Stacey Solomon and Victoria Beckham, basically. And she has this terrifying decision to make. And she says, go, gather all the Jews to be found in Susa and hold a fast on my behalf. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my young women will also fast as you do. Then I will go to the king, though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. What should you do? I guess there's guys in offices in London where evangelizing is pretty nearly against the law. We're beginning to hear stories of people losing their jobs because of things they've said, kind of just answering questions about what they believe. What should you do? Well, you should do your job as well as you can, seek the welfare of Babylon. But remember that God is king, not Richard Branson. And if the place that God has put you requires you to obey God and risk your job, well, then you pray and you risk your job. That is life in exile. You have to trust God. He's still there. You face persecution. You face suffering. You make bold choices. It's not a time to hide away. You be like Esther. And you need to read Esther to find out how fun it can be when you trust God and see what happens. Okay, that's the exile. Delayed there just because that's one of the key places the New Testament goes. So that's what our lives are like. But actually, all the way through the exile, the prophets keep looking ahead to the future. And you've got to ask, will the future just be more of the same? Are we going to go back to David, back to Solomon? And the answer always is no. We are going back to something better. So this is now the prophesied kingdom. Next point. And we're just going to kind of see the picture we build up from their predictions. But first we need the next picture. So two on. Yeah, there we go. And that's the box with the drawings that says prophecy and perspective. So do you remember 2 Samuel 7? Did you find 2 Samuel 7 confusing? We didn't spend very long of it. If we'd spent longer, I guess you would have done. Because, did you notice there were bits about the prophecy that can only be Solomon, not Jesus? Did you notice that? It said things like, he sins. He does things wrong. Can only be Solomon, not Jesus. So clearly it's a prediction about Solomon. He builds a house for God, all of that. But then you think, clearly there are bits in this prediction that can only be about Jesus and not Solomon. He lives forever. He rules as king forever. So what is going on? Well, here's how I think it's a helpful way to think about how prophecy works. Here is what David sees. And the illustration is, imagine you're in the mountains going for a walk, looking ahead. Okay, so you are David, looking ahead up the mountain of time, and you see Solomon. With a prophecy in your hand, you think, yes, Solomon, this is all about Solomon. That's probably all he saw. But that is really just a matter of perspective. So it's like when you do go for a walk in the mountains, like the scouts do all the time, I assume, when they're here. Maybe not when they're here, there are no mountains in Essex. But you get to the top of a huge hill and you think you've made it, but just ahead of it, you realize, annoyingly, there's about another 50 tops. So let's just click again. Really what's going on is that. So David is the eyeball, looking at Solomon, who's the one in the middle, and Solomon is all that he can see. But actually, there's always more in the words there than were just about Solomon. So just click a few more times, let's see, there we go, there he is, there's Jesus again, and there we go. So actually, as you read the prophecy, from our point of view, we can see more than David could, because we've gone beyond Solomon. And we're looking ahead to the stuff that is about Jesus in the future. These have always been words that were more truly about Jesus than they were about Solomon. And we could, it's quite an interesting question, how much they really saw that until Solomon dies. So actually, some of the prophecies I gave you to look at this morning, my guess is they always would have realized that this is far, far more than we ever thought, because it seems so much bigger. But actually, we can look back with the New Testament and see everything that they were talking about. So, under the prophesied kingdom, let's have a look at people. Let's have a look at people. So, people. We need to have, Jeremiah 16, or Ezekiel 36, or Isaiah 56, says we're going to have more people than we ever had before. We're going to have a new Exodus, Jeremiah 16. We're going to have a full number of people, as in former times, Ezekiel 36. But just look at Isaiah 56. So it's worth turning there now. Let's look at Isaiah 56. And here is the blessing to all the nations being talked about. You need to know that foreigners were banned from the temple, and you need to know that eunuchs were banned from the temple. They were both banned from full membership in the prototype temple. So can we have next person, Mike? Can you read verse 5?
I will give in my house and within my walls
and who's that talking about? Verse 4, talking about the eunuchs. Then verse 7, can we have?
These I will bring to my holy mountain, make them joyful in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and their sacrifices will be accepted on my altar. My house will be called a house of prayer for all people.
Thank you. And who's that talking about? Verse 6, it's talking about the foreigners. So we're going to have a people, but suddenly it's including everybody, including foreigners and eunuchs, and it'll be a new people, verse 8, made of Israel and everybody else. Okay, that's people. I think we can click and have people. Okay, keep going. There we go. And then click again. Let's look at place. Who had Isaiah 65? No one wants to volunteer. It was that side of the room. Are you still there? Put your hand up if your neighbour had Isaiah 65 when you talked earlier. Okay, that's easier, isn't it? So tell us, what is promised in Isaiah 65? Poke your neighbour, volunteer them. So that's Izzy, is that? Yeah. Yep. So where are we? New creation. New heavens and new earth, verse 17. Yeah, no weeping, no distress. What else is good about it? Other people can join in. Place of blessing. So yeah, that's good. Place of rest as well, 21 to 22. What else do we learn? People going to live a really long time. Looks like we're dealing with the problem of death. No more injustice. Someone over here. They'll enjoy the fruit of their labour, so the curses are being reversed. And just, I've gone, peace among the animals. Do you see verse 25? So it is good news for all the animals except one. Which animal is it not good news for? Serpent. Isn't that interesting? So we have a new place, a new creation, like Eden but better, which is a lot like Revelation 21. Okay, so we've got a new place. Then relationship, there it is. We have a final temple. So in Ezekiel, we have a prophecy of a temple that is a cube. Where's that familiar from? Place that's a cube. This one is 8 kilometers around. There is a river of water flows from the door. And there are trees whose leaves give healing on either side. Where's that sound like? Revelation 22. Okay, who had Zechariah 9? Same game, volunteer neighbor. There we go. Okay, Zechariah 9, what are we looking for? Yes, so we're looking for a king again. He's going to end the war. What do we learn about him? Yes. He's going to be humble. So we've got this kind of weird double thing going. So how much territory he's going to rule? Yeah. Sea to sea. He's going to be a conquering king, but he's going to be humble and arrive on a donkey. He's going to be bring salvation, a rescuing king. Which is 2 Samuel 7 at its biggest, isn't it? That ruling king, but with the sort of humble thing. Okay, who had Isaiah 53? I think this side of the room has been very quiet. Anyone over here have Isaiah 53? Here we go. Okay, so what have we got in Isaiah 53?
He's going to bear our sorrows and problems against God.
Yeah, thank you. Keep going. Other things about Isaiah 53. So you have an innocent servant who's not done anything wrong, but he's going to bear our sorrows. What else is going to happen? Take our sins. What's going to happen to him? He's going to be crushed. He's going to be killed. So we finally have a sacrifice that is better than a goat. We have someone who is human. Verse 10, we're told that God did this. Put this innocent one with the transgressors, which means verse 12, he will be able to make intercession for sinners. He will be able to sort out the problem of sin. So we're looking for a suffering servant. Who had Jeremiah 31? Yep. A new covenant. A new covenant that's not like the old one. In what way? What's going to be different? The law will be written on their hearts. What was the big problem with the old covenant? What kept going wrong? Sin kept going wrong. We kept breaking it. New one on our hearts. And you might have got Ezekiel 11 on the sheets. No, you might want to put Ezekiel 11 on the sheets. The offering of taking out this heart of stone that can only sin and putting in a heart of flesh. A new covenant where we will want to keep the law. Okay, now that is just a selection of things that appear in the prophets. Do you remember, I don't know if we have got it, clicks, let's see if we've got it. No, go back. Yes, yeah, that was it. Yeah, there we go. So do you see the arrow off the ski jump? We're pointing to something huge and enormous. Put it all together. These are the promises of people and place and relationship as we've never seen them. Bigger and huger and more secure, and of a crusher who will finally crush sin and Satan. and of a king who will really rule forever. But do you see the kind of new note, the surprise we're getting, is of a humble king who will suffer, and of a sacrifice that will deal with sin. And I think, like the angels in the sketches, after 1,500 years, we really want to know what it is going to look like. What is this rescue going to look like? But before we do, we need to finish the Old Testament. So click on 2.3, the return from exile. Or as I've called it is a mini kingdom. You need to do that, Austin Powers. It is a mini kingdom because it's quite small and disappointing. So God's promise of a return, it comes true. We have regime change in Babylon. In fact, while Daniel is telling the king, you're going to be changed, there are already the soldiers of Cyrus the Persian swimming up the sewer to come and stop them. And so Ezra 1 verse 1, to fulfill the word that God spoke through the prophet Jeremiah, he stirred up Cyrus, king of Persia, to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem. Isn't that amazing? Like their chess pieces. The superpower of the day, there you go, bang, let's have Jerusalem back. You'll do what I tell you, Cyrus. And so they go home and they begin rebuilding Jerusalem. It's very hard, there's lots of opposition, it takes a long time, but they rebuild a temple and a city. And there are hints as well, that was quicker, there are hints as well that there's going to be the line of David. So 2 Kings, just have a look at this. 2 Kings 25. So 2 Kings doesn't quite end with the destruction of Jerusalem. So do you remember we said there are 2 kings? There is the king who surrenders and is taken into Babylon, and his name is King Jehoiakim. And there is the king whose children are killed and his eyes pulled out. But here we go. Can we have next person back? Go back in the line. Someone nudge. Here we go. So 2 Kings. 2 Kings 25, can you read verses 27 to 30? I think this is like the moment at the end of the film that sets up the sequel. So could you read 2 Kings 25, verses 27 to 30?
In the 37th year of the exile of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, in the year Evil-Marduk, became king of Babylon. He believed Jehoiakim, king of Judah, but he did this on the 7th day of the 12th month.
Do you see, it's like the bit at the end of the Batman film where you put the Joker in prison and we've dealt with it, it's all over, and then just the final shot of the film is the Joker looking through it or something like that. He's still alive. It's like that. So we thought that all the kings were dead, but then just at the end of the book, we go and get Jehoiakim out of prison and we give him some food. What's going to happen? Who knows where he's going to go? And when Ezra comes back to Jerusalem, he comes back with a guy called Zerubbabel, which is a good name. Those of you thinking of having children, Zerubbabel. There you go. And he is Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel. And Shealtiel is a bloodline that 1 Chronicles 3 will tell us goes back to Jehoiakim, the captive. And Haggai 2, verse 23 begins making promises again to a son of David. We've returned from the exile. So let's put that on the diagram. There we go, that little uptick. We have returned from exile, but it is still very, very small. So next person along needs to read Ezra 3, which is about 3 books further on from 2 Kings. Ezra 3, verse 12 and 13. Do you see? And they come back and they rebuild a temple, they rebuild the walls, and they go, "Ray, we've got the temple again, Ray!" And all the young ones are really excited. But anybody old enough to remember what the temple used to look like sits in the corner weeping. Because this is now so small. It's such a come down. There are so few people. The city is empty. There are other nations living in the land all around Jerusalem. So many people have died and never came back. And you'd think even that would be okay. Even that we started with one old man. Surely we can rebuild from there. All of that would be okay. But worst of all, come on one book further to Nehemiah and chapter 13. Worst of all, sin is still there. Sin has come back with them. And that especially worryingly, the sin of Solomon has come back. So at Nehemiah 13, he comes back on a visit. Nehemiah, he's been away on his day job in the imperial courts. And he comes back, and while he's been away, they have all been marrying unbelievers, which is understandable. There aren't many people, not many to choose from. But Nehemiah comes home and he is terrified. Could we have next person, verse 26?
Did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin on account of such women? Among the many nations, there was no king like him, and he was beloved by his God. And God, being the king of Israel, nevertheless, foreign women did even him.
Do you see the point? It'd be interesting, wouldn't it, to have a visit of Nehemiah to British churches now or to our CUs or something. Because I think most of us think that the sort of rule about don't go out with people who aren't Christians, don't marry people who aren't Christian, we think it's just a kind of silly rule. But Nehemiah is absolutely terrified because he sees it means nothing has changed. I think he gives you a helpful test to see if it's all right to go out with someone who isn't a Christian. Basically, the test is, are you wiser than Solomon? Because if you're wiser than Solomon, then it's fine. Basically, okay, Solomon, by the way, was the wisest man who ever lived. But Solomon married these people who believed in different gods, and it led him away from gods. Nehemiah can see that this sort of... go to the diagram again. Go back one. This sort of up is, I think, what they call in the city a dead cat bounce. Do you know what that means? So if you drop a cat out of a window, even a dead cat can bounce. And that's basically what this is, because sin has not been dealt with. The return is as doomed as the old prototype, and we're still waiting for the real answer to these prophecies. We're still looking ahead to see what the answer is. So imagine that you are Nehemiah, you're terrified, you're kind of peering ahead into the gloom, you're wondering what is going to happen as things kind of tail off. Let's just think for a second what Nehemiah wants, what Nehemiah needs. Or put it another way, let's write the full list of specifications for the for God's rescue. Do you know, it looks like if you're on Amazon and you're buying a digital camera and by mistake you click the button that says full specifications and you get kind of 10 pages of things in letters you didn't even know how to read that tells you things you don't understand. So what would be the full specifications? Just turn to your neighbour and you've got some suggestions from me there on there. You want to add in things you think I've left out. You've got about 30 seconds. What are we looking for from the rescue? Go. Okay, that's long enough. Anyone have anything extra to add that we think isn't on the list? Extra things to throw in? Perfect relationship. Thank you. Other things? Unless everybody said perfect relationship a lot of times. Sinless. Yeah, we need to be sinless. Or the person needs to be sinless. Which were you saying? Either. Both. Yeah. Go on, one of that. Judgment. We need the world of sin to be judged and dealt with. Thank you. Any other? Eternal life. Is that not on the list? There you go. Eternal life. We need truth. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, we need to remake the world so it's not broken anymore. Yeah. All the things that begin with S, all the things that begin with D. Yeah. So just look down the list. I guess you had more in your groups. Things like a crusher from Genesis 3. A prophet. We're still waiting for a new Moses. A priest offer for sins. A temple where we can know God. A Passover lamb. Sacrifices for sin. A final son of David. That's the one that becomes, they call Messiah. We're waiting for the Messiah. It means anointed one, or if you translate that into Greek, it means Christ. We're waiting for the Christ. And we need a new exodus from slavery to sin. We need a real return from exile, because even though we're in Jerusalem, we're still really in exile to sin. We need new hearts so we won't sin. We need a new creation so there's no more suffering. And again, just look at how sin dominates that list. It is all of it hopeless unless God sends someone, and actually it looks like maybe an army of people, all the different jobs on that list, sends someone to deal with sin, because we are bad and we need rescuing. And I think that remains the hardest thing to accept about Christianity, to accept that at root, this is a religion for bad people who are in trouble and need to be rescued. It's very humbling, isn't it, to have to admit that. But that is what is all over the list. So Nehemiah, looking ahead, he wants all of those things. And we as people reading the Bible, we want it, we're waiting, we're tense and we're excited. And the Bible is a bit like a really well-made horror film. There's sort of tension, there's tension, and then the cat comes and you go, and it wasn't the cat. The cat isn't the thing. And then there is the pause, just the enormous silent pause. We want the crusher. Israel is like the cat. And then there's 400 years of silence. And then finally, when we're very, very tense, turn to Matthew chapter 1 and verse 1. And next person, going back, next row back, could you read us Matthew 1, verse 1?
Look up the genealogy of Jesus Christ, son of David, son of Abraham.
Thank you. No more genealogies from now on. Actually, there is one more. It's in Luke 3, but it's the same one. Same person. We found the crusher. No more genealogies. No need to keep flicking through people. Where is he? Where is he? Where is he? We found him. In fact, we found much, much more than just the crusher. Next person, Luke 1, 30 to 33. Here is the 2 Samuel 7, the throne of his father David, son of God. Next person, Hebrews. So Hebrews 7:23 to 8:1 has a load of stuff that's different. Just give us 8 verse 1. And this is just a clue for Bible reading. If you get a bit that says this is the main point of what we're saying, listen to that bit. So can you give us 8 verse 1, please?
Now the point in what we are saying is this. We have such a high priest, one who is seated at the right hand of the throne of the
Thank you. So we had old priests in the prototype, and the trouble with them was they died and they sinned. But this new priest, he is going to live forever, 7 verse 24. And also, 7:27, he has no need to offer for his own sins. He's not a sinful person. So we finally have the priest we've always wanted and needed. So do you see a curious thing that's happening? It is all bunching around one person. Bunching, that's a technical hair term. Anyone wearing bunches? Probably not, because you're not five. But that it's all bunching in on Jesus. Jesus is crusher, and he is king, and he is priest. And you might think that was just amazing multitasking, until just read Hebrews 7, verse 27. Next person back. Just pause there. Okay, imagine the scene. The priest is doing the offering today, and so he's got to stretch the victim out on the altar. There he goes. He's laying himself out on the altar. He's got to get the big knife and slit the throat. So he slit his own throat, and he's dead. And then he's got to get the blood and go into the holy place. That's going to be a bit of a problem, isn't it? How can he be priest and sacrificial victim at the same time? Let's just put the cross on the diagram, can we? One more click. There we go. So Jesus is priest and sacrifice. In fact, he is simultaneously everything we've ever wanted or needed. You can just run that through all the lists. He is the Passover lamb, 1 Corinthians 5. He brings a new covenant, which is where Hebrews 8 takes us, all the way Hebrews 8 verse 10 takes us to Jeremiah 31. This is the new covenant. Zechariah 9 kicks in 3 or 4 weeks' time now on Palm Sunday. When the king rides in on a donkey to introduce himself to his capital city. Isaiah 53 is quoted by Jesus and by Peter to explain the death of Jesus. Lots of John's gospel, that is a fight about who is a better prophet. Is it Jesus or is it Moses? Which isn't really fair, is it? Because Jesus actually is God's son and he's the word. He's the word of God. Colossians 1 says that everything you want to know about God look at Jesus. It all narrows in on him. All the promises are yes in him. And I've called it on your handout, the pinch in the hourglass. But I said that to some London students recently, and I realised they have no idea what an hourglass is. So I think we have a picture. There we go. That is an hourglass. Do you realise, so there's lots of things about Microsoft where they have these pictures and nobody knows what they mean anymore because you're too young. So that's the funny symbol that appears when you're waiting for things. Sand is meant to be pouring through the top. There's the other one, isn't there? When you click save, you know what that strange quaint square thing is? That's a floppy disk. Yeah, I've got some at home. Show you what those are. But anyway, so this is an hourglass. Imagine it on its side. Let's see if this works. There we go. And then imagine all of the things that we want on this side here. So click again. And there they are, down on this side. The huge Old Testament list. And they all pour in, converge in on Jesus. So if you know the Old Testament at all, you read the Gospels with your mouth open. You think all of the Old Testament, in fact, all of history, just zooms in, converges in, finds its truth, and pivots on Jesus. Imagine all of world history, all of the years, coming crashing in on Jesus, pivoting on him, and spinning out the other side into the future. Jesus is the pivot of history. So if you want to understand anything in the Old Testament, you need to push it through the pinch. Push it through Jesus and see what comes out on the other side. So I want us to do some kind of worked examples on that. So if you turn the page, you've got some space to make notes on this. And we're going to start off with people. Okay, so if we click, I think we can get people. Okay, so the idea, one of our big themes has been people. Where does that start? That starts with Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, when there were two people. Then it flows through the story of the Old Testament, doesn't it? And it develops a lot to Israel. So we end up with lots of people, ethnic, national Israel. Then you ask yourself, actually, whoever was really the people of God's? Whoever really lived under God's rule? Whoever did everything right? Whoever did what Adam and Eve should have done? Whoever did what Israel was meant to be? And you say, only actually one person, Jesus. He, in all of history, he is the person of God's, the only one who did what Adam was meant to be. By the way, do we fall into the trap of thinking Jesus is a bit weird, a bit inhuman because he didn't sin, a bit kind of not very human? Jesus is the only real human ever to live. Sin is the alien invader. Jesus is the real human being. But then the other side of Jesus, something very strange happens. Because the one person of Jesus, I think you can click, the one person of Jesus gets huge. Because we are his body. And we redefine it not just as ethnic Israel, not just as a few people, but every single believer gets a secure place as the people of God in Jesus. Jesus deserves it. He's the only one who deserves it. But you are part of his body now. You're part of him. You are the person of God. So you cannot lose your place in the new creation. Jesus is going to be there. He deserves to be there. You are his body, so you're there. See how that makes a difference, reading through the Old Testament. Why you don't have to be Jewish anymore. Fantastic if you are. All of the promises, all of the background, all of the history. But actually anybody who believes in Jesus, because he is the true people of God. Okay, let's have a go with place now. So click again. Okay, so we start back with Eden. That was the place, just a small little garden in the Garden of Eden. Does it develop? Does it develop through history? Yes, because it turns into Canaan or Israel. So we have a larger physical land, but still a limited one. Then it comes to Jesus. What happens then? Well, this is a bit more difficult because Jesus says, the whole earth is mine. I am king of the whole earth. But he also says, come and join my kingdom. And then he says, John 18:36, says, my kingdom is not of this world. So that is a bit strange, which means on the other side of Jesus, there is no physical territory. We totally redefine what it means to be the land of God. There is a place, but it's the promised land. in the new creation. We are the generation in the wilderness. We are the generation in exile. And the land is not the kind of physical acreage of Israel anymore. The land will be when Jesus comes back and we have the new creation, when every promise comes true. So when, when religious English people sing about building Jerusalem in this green and pleasant land, actually today was reasonably pleasant, wasn't it? And it will be green because it's been raining, but they're wasting their time. There's no point building Jerusalem now. Jerusalem is coming in the future. And more significantly, maybe, when some Americans pursue a certain foreign policy about Israel, not because of the people who live there, the Jewish people or the Palestinian people, but because they think God's promises still revolve around that acreage of land, well, they're wasting their time, or they're stuck in the pinch. The promises go into Jesus, and they come out looking different on the other side. Or actually, lots of the other problems we have about the Old Testament are because we just don't understand where the land is. So I had a friend called Juliet, who had been told you just had to read a promise in the Old Testament and believe it, and God would make it true for you if you believed it hard enough. And she read loads of promises that said things like, I will protect you, and I'll make you rich in the land, and I will shower you with money and with houses. And because she was a student nurse at South Bank, she was not rich, and she had no money and no houses and no land. So she had a problem. Is it that she's not believing hard enough? Is that she's not really a believer in Jesus? No. She is just stuck in the pinch, which sounds uncomfortable, doesn't it? And I think it was for her. See, the promises, if we were to point at where they come on the story, the promises come in the Canaan bit. And the promises of land blessing to Israel then, they are now promises to Christians in our land, in the new creation, when we get there. So I have no doubt that Juliet is going to be showered with every good thing in the land that God is taking her to, in the new creation. And I wanted her to relax about life now. So with that CU, we did a Bible overview for 6 or 7 weeks. Okay, do you get the method? Do you get how this works? So I put 5 stages on the sheet. So you're reading the Old Testament. You get to a bit you don't understand. And what you do is you unfold the diagram. You get the drawing out. And then you find the thing you're reading. So you find Juliet's promise about being rich in the land. So it belongs there in Canaan. And you say, okay, where are we? Which aspect of God's big plan are we rebuilding? Okay, so a promise of wealth, that is all about the land. That's all about building the bit to do with place. Okay, so think place. Okay, I need to think about place through the whole Bible. Right, starts in Eden, it goes Canaan. Does it develop? Yes, we go from Eden to Canaan to Solomon's kingdom to all the ends of the earth. That's what we're dealing with. The promise you'll be rich comes halfway through those promises. Okay, how does Jesus fulfill it? Well, lots of ways, mainly by saying the earth is his. Then you come through, question 5, where is Canaan now? Push it through the pinch. Well, Jesus said his kingdom is above. He promised that in his Father's house there are many rooms. Promised a prize, an inheritance, a reward to come. So you say to Juliet, well, you need to believe Jesus' promise that there will be a reward in the future. And believe that. Believe that he will make it true. Okay, do you see what we're doing? In groups, just for a couple of minutes, have a go at temple. So you're reading the Old Testament. You find something about the temple. Have a go at that in your groups just quickly now. You've got 4 minutes. Where have you got to? Which stage have you got to? You on the 5th stage? Nodding. Okay, let's pause there. Let's have a look. I think this one is quite hard, isn't it? So if we click, I think we get one that says temple. There we go. So first question, where are we on the diagram? If we're looking at a passage about the temple. Second? Old Testament, what's happened, what hasn't happened? Solomon has happened. We're probably in the bit. We're either rebuilding it with Ezra and Nehemiah or in the bit where we're a bit worried about it and where it's happening. Okay, good. Second question. Which big aspect are we building? Relationship. Brilliant. Temple's about relationship. Excellent. Okay, any development in relationship as we go through the prototype? What kind of stages do we get in relationship? So perfect in the beginning, face to face with Adam and Eve, then tabernacle, so we kind of lose it for a bit, though God is with Abraham and Isaac, but yeah, then we tabernacle, we get it back, and then temple. So temple is kind of pinnacle of that development back towards relationship. Okay, we're doing well. Fourth bit, how does Jesus fulfill temple? Any ideas? He dwells with man. Jesus comes to be God with us. That's what Emmanuel means. One of his titles, or John 1 verse 14, Jesus tabernacled among us. So if you'd seen Jesus, you'd seen God. Okay, any other ways that Jesus fulfills temple? Yeah, he actually occupies lots of, well, most of the key jobs in the temple. Yeah, thank you. So all the things the temple meant was meant to do in terms of dealing with sin, Jesus does them. Thank you. Anyone, does he even go beyond that? I don't think of somewhere Jesus says he is the temple. Yeah, you destroy the temple and I'll rebuild it in 3 days. That's in John 2, comes up in different places. Because his body is like a temple. His body is the temple. Cool, thank you. You can have Colossians 1 as well, fullness of God with us, that sort of thing. Okay, then, fifth question. Let's push it through the pinch. Okay, so what do we say about temple now on the other side of Jesus? So Doug says doesn't exist. Is that right? Yeah, physically. Why don't we need a temple? Yeah. Thank you. We are the temple. So Jesus dies, he rose, he's in heaven. Do you remember what there won't be in the new creation? A temple. Don't need a temple anymore. So the temple now, well, yeah, the Spirit dwells inside us. And the Ezekiel promise of a new heart is that the Spirit, God, comes and lives in us. John 14 talks about the Father and the Son and the Spirit living in us by his Spirit. So you are the temple. God dwells in you. You can just think how astonished Moses would have been at that idea. You're actually going to live in all of them. That's not a good idea. How can that work? So again, just think of the implications of that in terms of being, well, look, we've lost face-to-face, and it's gone dark in the new creation, but that says face-to-face at the bottom there. So let's just think about, again, not getting stuck in the pinch. So Christians who try and make their church building or their church meeting like the temple so that they can meet with God, what are they doing? They are wasting their time, aren't they? I don't know if you, did you come all the way here to have a great worship meeting so you could meet with God? Yeah, what a waste of a journey. You came to Chingford to try and meet with God when he lives in your heart. And he was there in Euston. You're the temple. God lives in you. And people who try and decorate their church buildings in deliberately temple kind of style, what a waste of time. You're the temple. God lives in you. You can't be closer to God than you are now. And when Jesus returns, only then will all the frustrations of not being face to face with God, all the frustrations of being a temple in a body of sin will be removed and we'll be face to face. Okay, you begin to get the idea of how this changes how you read the Bible. Find the big thing we're developing, work out what the story is, push it through Jesus, see how it applies to us now. Okay, questions on that tomorrow if you'd like them. Let's just finish up with point six, driving it home. And after everything we've seen, through a day of quite long talks, everything we've seen, people are looking kind of, oh, you've said quite a lot today. Just one simple question. What do you think of Jesus after everything we've said? What do you think of Jesus? I tend to pray in one dimension only. So I kind of fixate on one thing about Jesus is king. So I go, dear King Jesus, thank you that you are king. Help me to obey you because you are my king. Amen. Or something. And can you sort of taste the huge richness of everything we've seen in the Old Testament and what it does to how we think and feel about Jesus? Think of Jesus with all of time spinning around him, everything pivoting in on him. It is all about him. He's the center of everything. So I think because most of us don't know the Old Testament very well and don't read it very often, we're quite kind of thin in what we think of Jesus and how we pray about him how we feel about it. If I said to you, okay, you've got half an hour. I'd like you to just pray about Jesus for half an hour. Can you do that? Off you go. Again, I wonder if we'd struggle. I wonder if we'd struggle to keep thinking of new, amazing, wonderful things. Well, I've put, you might want to take the list of specifications. You might want to do this tonight, take some time. The list of kind of prototype specifications. Just pray through each one of those. Jesus is the crusher. He stamps on Satan's head. Isn't that a brilliant thing? Jesus is the prophet. He really tells you everything. He stands between you and God so you know God properly. You can talk to God. Just take all of them. Kind of pray in 3D in full colour. And I've put on the passage, the sheet, some kind of Old Testament passages that do that. I want to finish with one of them. I'll read out a short bit of it and then I'll say amen and hand over to Kev. I'll just pause after each bit that I think we now understand better maybe than we did this morning or we've been reminded of. So this is Revelation 5. Where they're singing about Jesus in the new creation. So they say, "Worthy are you, Jesus, to take the scroll and to open its seals, for you were slain. And by your blood you ransomed people for God. From every tribe and language and people and nation. And you have made them a kingdom and priests to our God. And they shall reign on the earth. Worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and wealth and wisdom and might and honor and glory and blessing." Amen.